fourth case this morning is Oblix against Winicky. Up to the podium, you know.
Thank you, Your Honor. I should be fine, but I appreciate you letting me know that. Good morning. Jeffrey Bosley of Winston & Strawn for Appellant Oblix, Inc. At issue in this appeal is whether the district court erred by considering disputes which the parties agreed should be submitted to the arbitrator. This matter arises from a complaint filed by Oblix in the Northern District of Illinois to compel the appellee, Felicia Winicky, to arbitrate claims arising out of the termination of her at-will employment.
Why does Oblix want to compel her to arbitrate claims? Why doesn't Oblix want her to go away? Right? If she files a lawsuit, Oblix then says that lawsuit is no good because you want to arbitrate. But I don't understand why it's in Oblix's interest to compel somebody to go into some form of litigation with it. That's like filing a lawsuit against somebody saying, please sue me now. I want an injunction compelling the defendant to sue me now.
Your Honor, the fact of this case, the way this case came into being, is there was a charge of discrimination filed in Chicago, in the Chicago office of the EEOC. A right to sue letter was issued. It was clear that Ms. Winicky was not going to abide by the arbitration agreement and filed in the Northern District.
She files a lawsuit. She finally did, of course, as a counterclaim in this case. And then you say, we move to dismiss the lawsuit or refer it to arbitration. Here's the agreement. I just don't understand the idea when you don't have a grievance with her, her grievance is with you, filing a lawsuit and asking the judge to demand that litigation occur in a different form.
Your Honor, I don't see how the order of who filed when changes the result in this case. There is an enforceable agreement to arbitrate, and Ms. Winicky's claims, as pled in the counterclaim, are subject to that agreement.
Once she filed the counterclaim, we had an Article III case or controversy. It's not clear to me that we had one where she filed the counterclaim.
Before she filed the counterclaim, we had the threat of litigation. We had
we had
an understanding she was going to breach the agreement, so we pushed the issue in an effort to get this case to arbitration more quickly.
That her mere filing with the EEOC violated the arbitration agreement?
No, that's not my position. My position is that, and it's not in dispute, that Ms. Winicky intended to sue in district court concerning that charge upon receipt of the right to sue notice. There was going to be
sure.
a suit in district court.
People intend a lot of things. I mean, I suppose
don't happen.
You know, depending on how you wanted to handle that threat, it might or might not have materialized. But I mean, arbitration, as we all know, isn't free either, even for the company, particularly in light of the fact that you were offering to, you know, take care of one potentially troublesome point by paying all the expenses.
I understand that, Your Honor. To Judge Easterbrook's point, it takes two parties to make the lawsuit go away. We've now been in litigation in this case for 19 months. It would be inappropriate for me to get into the settlement positions of the parties, and I won't do that. But I think it is appropriate for me to say that for this case to go away would have required Ms. Winicky to change her mind at the onset, which now it's clear that she was not going to do that. And since the case has been
filed,
I don't want to devote too much of the argument to this because she did file the counterclaim. Go ahead.
Is your principal argument on appellate jurisdiction the May 7th events, or are you relying principally on the fancier arguments, such as the Rutledge case?
We're arguing both, Your Honor. The primary argument, however, I believe, is that we did make a timely request for an extension of the appeal deadline as to the April 23rd
order. Within
the 30-day period, and that request was never opposed.
Is it the extension request, or is it the fact that you filed the motion to reconsider within 10 days, and thus nothing really happened until the district court decided to deny it.
That's
an invitation of the district court, I might add.
That is also true, that within the 10-day period, within the 10-day window, all parties represented by counsel, or through counsel, more accurately, were in front of the district court, and it was decided there would be a motion for reconsideration at the court's invitation. And due to the timing of that decision, that our position is that was the making of a motion for reconsideration upon agreement of the parties, and there was a briefing schedule established for the motion. In effect a tolling motion.
Does anything turn on this, since this is an interlocutory appeal? Right. When one talks about extending the time and all of that, that's stuff that applies to a final judgment. But the Supreme Court held in Barron's against Pelletier that there may be multiple interlocutory appealable orders if there is an interlocutory doctrine. So the question I have is, isn't the district court's reconsideration order independently appealable under Section 16 of the Arbitration Act? Does anything turn on the time gap or when people filed their documents, given the language of Section 16?
Your Honor, I believe that it is an independently appealable argument.
So you can get all the relief you need from an appeal from the order denying reconsideration that you would get from the original April 23rd order, namely arbitration.
Yes. We would get the relief we're seeking, yes, arbitration.
So it really nothing turns on any of this, as far as I can see, at least given Section 16 and Barron.
Well, Obelix agrees. And I mean, in terms of turning to the merits of the claim, in terms of the merits of this dispute, our primary...
My real jurisdictional question is whether the appeal isn't premature, since all the district court said in the end is, well, I can't rule out the possibility of unconscionability.
The appeal is not premature, and there are cases from this court, including Boomer, which have clearly rejected that position. That our position...
Yeah, I understand. It's not clear to me that Boomer was right, but... Maybe Stare Decisis has its claims.
Well, I also think that there are other reasons why it's not premature, which is the grounds for the district court's ruling dealt with issues of fact concerning whether this alleged issues of fact concerning whether this agreement was unconscionable. Our position is that those are not issues of fact, but what the judge is really discussing are issues of law.
I understand, but that, of course, is... Whenever a judge denies summary judgment or denies a motion to dismiss the complaint or something like that, the losing party says, well, but you should have and could have. Doesn't make it appealable. Now, Boomer said that Section 16 departs from that understanding as well, so that if all the judge does is put off the day of decision, that's immediately appealable.
Well,
it's not clear that that's right as an original matter, but it is the law of this circuit, so let's skip it and get ahead to the merits.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that in terms of the true dispute that is primarily the issue in this case, it is who had the jurisdiction to determine the issues that the district court determined. And it's Obelix's position that those issues should have been resolved under prima facie and under the broad language of the agreement by the arbitrator in the first instance. And that Judge Darrow should not have gotten to the result that he did. Our position is that Judge Darrow, the district court. Speaking of the district court, what we assert happened is the district court started at the end rather than starting at the beginning. Because starting at the beginning, starting with the analysis as required by the FAA, starting with the arbitration provision, Section 10A is extremely broad. And under the cases of this circuit, this broad language, any dispute arising to or relating to, or relating to the construction, interpretation, performance, or breach of the agreement, involves any dispute that has its origin or genesis in the contract.
It is a broad clause, but you make the argument that it actually falls under the first options rule, that the arbitrator even determines arbitrability. And that, I think, is a bold step to take, given the fact that the Supreme Court said such an agreement has to be expressed very clearly. Usually the district court will determine whether it has something arbitrable in front of it. Is there an agreement? You know, does this fall within the scope of the agreement? If so, then you send it off to arbitration. Obviously, if not, then you keep it. And we know that the prima paint rule exists, and I understand your argument about that, that the issues that she's raising are the same broad issues that would that aren't unique to the arbitration clause. But surely the district court was entitled to decide whether this is an arbitrable dispute.
Your Honor, I think the best way to address that is to just speak for a moment about what I'm not, or Oblix is not, proposing that this court do, which is to take away from the court, the district court, in all circumstances, the issue of arbitrability. But we do believe this falls under first options, as interpreted by the recent cases, Pacific Air and Housa. There, these two, excuse me, these two recent decisions make clear that arbitrators can determine issues of unconscionability. And under this agreement, Ms. Winicki's arguments involve an interpretation of how this agreement will work. Which provision will apply to her claims, 10B or 10A? Will there be a limitation of the remedies available to her under the agreement? All of those require an interpretation of the agreement. So in this case, because there is an integrated agreement, and because Winicki's arguments raise issues about how this integrated agreement will be interpreted, the arbitrator should determine arbitrability under first options and prima facie.
Well, in a sense, you're just saying the arbitrator should resolve the case. What if California had an extremely aggressive rule about unconscionability, and it said, we never enforce any take-it-or-leave-it contract, car rental agreement.
Unconscionability of everything, not just arbitration.
Everything. We don't do car rental agreements. We don't do, you know, tickets to the opera. We don't do anything. Every agreement in the state of California that's...
The foreign selection clause on the back of the Carnival Cruise Lines ticket would not be enforced in California.
If they had such a rule, then, under the logic that the Supreme Court has told us to apply, namely that arbitration agreements are, you know, up or down, treated just the same as other agreements, this would be a non-arbitrable agreement, right?
I will say, being from California, that it wouldn't surprise anybody in the room if California did something very surprising. But they haven't done that. Even in California, and there are California cases cited in our briefs.
So things can get worse even in California. In your view, not obviously your adversary's view.
I will stipulate to that. Things can change all the time in California and get even curiouser and curiouser. But but even under Armendariz and Littler versus Otto Stiegler, another case cited by us in the brief, California has not gone that far yet. In California, it is required that there both be.
Thought at one time that California had gone that far, but that they overruled those decisions and loose forward.
Yes, and then loose forward was reconsidered, and part of that case was...
No, I'm referring to the en banc decision in loose forward. They understood Armendariz to allow enforcement of these kinds of things.
Well, and our argument is that whoever decides this issue, whether it be the court or the arbitrator, and we believe that it should be the arbitrator, California law needs to be interpreted in a way that's consistent with both the Federal Arbitration Act and the Supreme Court's decisions in Pacific Air and Housam and first option.
Right, the line I was simply trying to draw is nothing in the Federal Arbitration Act tells the states what kind of contract law they're supposed to have as long as it doesn't discriminate
against arbitration.
Yes, and to the extent that we get into loose forward, those are cases which discriminate against the type of clause at issue. There have been cases which have put more and more special requirements on pre-dispute employment arbitration agreements than other types of contracts.
Armendariz says we have this special rule for arbitration, it just can't be enforced. But both Judge Wood's question and mine have to do with their general law, right? If you get from your seller in California a warranty that says the warranty is limited to 90 days, and that's on the back of a tiny form, and California says, we just don't enforce these tiny forms, what you've got is an unlimited warranty.
Mm-hmm.
Then I assume they could do the same thing for arbitration clauses. But
if they create,
we don't have any particular reason to believe that they refuse to enforce 90-day warranty terms written in tiny type on sales contracts.
In fact, we have reason to believe the opposite based on the cases cited in our briefs, yeah, and based on the fact that there is both a substantive and a procedural requirement for a contract to be unconscionable for any contract in California. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Winnick.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by pointing out that I disagree with an interpretation of the contract that views the arbitration clause in this instance as a broad one. It is specifically limited to four categories of claims: those disputes that arise under the interpretation, the construction, the performance, and the breach of the agreement. And this claim is much more limited than the cases that on which Oblix relies. Prima Paint had an unlimited clause. In Prima Paint, the clause stated that the disputes arising out of the agreement were arbitrable. And here,
why does it narrow it if you say either arising out of or relating to virtually anything about the agreement? Isn't something relating to the agreement your performance, or whether you get fired, or whether somebody is using pregnancy or some other impermissible ground?
Well, I would believe that's the performance. They're referring to the performance of that agreement, not the performance of her work. The only thing that the contract focuses on are the arbitration provisions, and that the fact that the arbitration agreement simply states that the contract of employment is at will. And again, if this was an unlimited contract provision or arbitration provision, as the provisions in Sweet Dreams and Prima Paint, it simply wouldn't have this interpretation, construction, performance, or breach language in it. All the cases that they cite have none of these four categorical limits in there. They added those limits, they mean something, and they restrict the scope of that arbitration agreement. And given the rest of that agreement, given that there's only an at-will provision and then arbitration clauses and obligations upon Ms. Winicky, I don't believe that retaliation claims and discrimination claims and commission claims fall within the scope of that agreement. Ms. Winicky,
let me ask you the unconscionability question about California law. Take my warranty example. If you buy a toaster and you discover when you open the box that it's got a card inside, you never saw it until you open the box, and the card says, we have a limited warranty on this toaster. It lasts for 90 days, service and parts, and so on. After 90 days, you're responsible. Does California enforce that limited warranty, or would it say, well, what you get is the UCC standby, which is unlimited warranty for non-merchantable goods?
I believe that it would be, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, not the whole question, but just the...
Yeah, you discover when you buy a consumer product mm-hmm. that either on some separate card or on the contract or in some other place, you never offered any negotiation over it, there's a clause that says, we are offering a limited warranty, 90 days, a year, and your toaster or computer goes bluey after 366 days, and you file a lawsuit in California and say, I'm entitled to the presumptive unlimited warranty provided by the UCC unless the warranty is effectively disclaimed. This was not an effective disclaimer because it was in tiny type and we didn't negotiate over it. What would California do with that case?
I think that California law might agree that that is enforceable simply because consumers know that when they're purchasing products, they might have a card in there that provides a limited warranty.
Do we know concretely what California does do?
I do not.
So your adversary cited some cases that to the effect that California enforces those, and I thought you might have checked off on California's general law of unconscionability and form contracts to see what it is.
I simply know that the decisions coming out of California in employment disputes where the parties do not have equal...
Yeah, the problem is that if California has a special law for arbitration, that, as a matter of federal law, is preempted. The only thing it can have, the only thing we can enforce, is California's general contract law. And that's why I'm trying to figure out what California's general contract law is.
Well, I believe that the cases, the subordinate, the employment cases coming out state that the contract law in that case say that arbitration clauses are unenforceable if they're unconscionable. I don't know the general law outside of the employment realm. There's an issue regarding Ms. Winicky attacking and challenging the entire contract, and I just wanted to state that those cases cited by Oblix tend to relate to fraud and the inducement attacks and similar attacks on the entire contract rather than specific arbitration provisions.
What's the difference, though? I mean, the things that you cite that or the things on which you rely that would make this an unconscionable contract, such as the fact that it's take it or leave it, such as the fact that it's one-sided, don't seem to me to be unique at all to paragraph 10 and its various subparts. I mean, the contract is here in the appendix, and it has a number of parts about, you know, who owns inventions and about assignment of intellectual property rights and so on and so forth. So I don't know how your argument actually zeroes in on the arbitration clause as opposed to being something analogous to, obviously not the same as, the fraud and the inducement point in Prima Paint.
Well, Ms. Winicky is simply raising claims of retaliation and non-payment of commissions and discrimination. And
I know what she's doing, but, you know, for example, there's a confidential information provision in the contract, and she didn't have any chance to bargain about that. It was just given to her. Intellectual property is very valuable for people, and sometimes people do want to negotiate about the extent to which they retain rights over things that they helped create, even in a position of employee, the extent to which they become the property of the employer, what has to be kept confidential. There's no off-the-shelf necessary provision. So I just don't know why, say, paragraph 2 isn't susceptible to the same criticisms that you're applying to paragraph 10.
We're not arguing
I know you're not arguing that, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, just as in Prima Paint, they didn't care about the other provisions of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
The only one they cared about was the arbitration clause, but the fraud and the inducement argument of necessity was going to undercut the entire contract, not just the arbitration agreement. There was nothing that dissected out the arbitration agreement there, and I'm having trouble seeing what dissects this one out.
Well, I think the cases coming out of California dissect those out.
Judge Easterbrook said the Supreme Court of the United States has said the Federal Arbitration Act does not permit states. Think of doctors' associates. Think of, you know, there are a lot of cases where the Supreme Court has said we now have a federal policy that preempts state law to the extent it's trying to disfavor or put special burdens on arbitration. I mean, we can debate that. I mean, Congress may be debating it, but at the moment, that's the law.
Well, I think that Prima Paint was focused primarily on two parties with equal bargaining power, and I think they specifically recognized that fact.
But then the court has gone further steps down that path. It has basically said the fine print arbitration clause is fine, the Carnival Cruise clause is fine, Vimar de Seguros is fine. Again, I mean, I think you're touching a very interesting policy issue, but one for at the moment that the Supreme Court has addressed.
Well, I think that the Supreme Court of California took into...
Of course, my example of the card in a box was not fanciful. We had a case where the card in the box is an arbitration clause. That's Hill against Gateway 2000, and we held it as a matter of federal law. The card in the box is enforceable. Your position would require us to overrule Gateway 2000, although you don't really grapple with that case.
Well, I simply think that the facts are distinguishable, and in employment cases you have a unique set of circumstances where you have...
But why would it make any difference whether the thing is employment or, as in Gateway 2000, a computer?
Because the policy behind statutory rights are those public policy rights to protect employees. And those public policy rights...
The kind of argument you're now making is an argument that the Supreme Court was not persuaded by in Gilmer, where in Gilmer and subsequent cases it said that employment rights are included within arbitration, and it said that with respect to antitrust and RICO and securities.
Well,
all of these
city.
Are things under federal law, which the Supreme Court has said are treated just like anything else for purposes of arbitration. It's awfully hard to say, you know, we shouldn't follow computer precedents because employment is different in the face of cases like Gilmer. How could we? Wouldn't pass the straight face test.
Well, I think that the Supreme Court of California is illustrative. I think that it's the controlling law. I think it's correct, and they do take into consideration the public policy behind protecting employees who have employment agreement adhesive employment agreements forced upon them. I think that's the distinction between those cases and California law as it stands. I'd like to also address the point raised earlier about this proceeding being premature. Arbitration is to efficiently, inexpensively, and fairly arbitrate issues. And as we know, the litigation has been going on for 19 months. And Ms. Winicky would request that despite the odd procedural dynamic of this case being up on a motion for summary judgment, that this court recognize that the motion for summary judgment is truly a motion to compel, otherwise this court would have no jurisdiction, and that there are no material issues of fact, because there are no facts that are going to be raised from this point on that are going to change the outcome, whatever it may be, regarding the arbitration issue. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Bosman?
Yes, Your Honor, just two brief points. I think that both through the briefs and in oral argument today, it is clear that Ms. Winicky's arguments concerning the unconscionability of the arbitration provisions is really one purely of law that they're making and not one of fact. And as such, because it's an issue of law and in light of the Supreme Court precedents that apply here and this court's rulings, the arbitrator is the proper, arbitration rather, is the proper form to determine unconscionability. And in terms of the specific claims and appellee's attempt to use language in the agreement to actually limit the words arising out of and relating to, that conflicts with binding precedent of this court and the Supreme Court. And it also conflicts with the language of the agreement, which in the preamble and in Article 1, or Section 1, rather, of the arbitration agreement, there is an agreement to be an at-will employee with the company. And in terms of her at-will employment, that is a defense to all of her discrimination claims. These claims clearly arise from the termination of her at-will employment.
Thank you, counsel.
So, thank you very much.
The case is taken under advisement.